Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, a reporter on Alternet and the Huffington Post. I've been covering health and green for over 20 years, I'm proud to say. And every week here on Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, I bring you all of the news and information, experts and thought leaders who connect the dots between our personal health and our total health environment. Our show begins every week with a beautiful piece of music by one of my favorite artists, Bobby McFerrin, and this reminds us that as much as we think of ourselves as individuals and independent and, you know, each kind of actualizing themselves or making do in the world in one way or another, in fact, we all are planted in nature's garden, and this is something that we have to honor, remember, connect with, and protect. And that's our theme, our underlying theme of every single Connect the Dots program. I've been here on Progressive Radio for over a year and a half and going strong with some terrific guests. I have another one, terrific speaker today on a really great and very misunderstood topic, which I'm thrilled about. And you can also check our archives because we've had a whole series of terrific people on this show who it's been my honor and pleasure to speak with, and we're continuing that tradition today of informing you about how to connect the dots for health. As regular listeners know, I begin every week with one or more action opportunities, ways to plug in. For 20 years, I shared all of the great information from the integrative medicine wisdom about how to take care of our personal health through diet, exercise, stress management, and just a whole great bunch of consciousness techniques even. But in fact, we're not going far enough. It's great to begin there, but we have to go a step further to protect our habitat, the food that we need, the water that we drink, because we can't just rely on an individual solution if we don't also take care of our habitat and the society that impacts our habitat. And, and that's how I became more and more moving from individual health reporting and advice to really looking at all of the things that we do or allow or fail to do or could be doing to better our health on a systemic level. And that's what we talk about every week. Today's, and therefore it's really important for listeners who are concerned about health both to do the good personal actions and follow the thought leaders and practitioners who have wisdom to offer, but it's equally important to get together in community and to take action where we need to protect that which supports our life and health. So that's why I begin every show with an action, and today's action is really a terrific one. As regular listeners to the show will know, I often cover fracking, which has been a nationwide concern in terms of its impact on water supplies, food supplies, health, and you know, even the ecological balance of planet Earth. There's a terrific action happening tomorrow, and that is September 20th through the 21st as well in Philadelphia. I very often cover events in New York State, where I'm located. Out of New York City, out of Brooklyn, New York, but it's also the concern about fracking is really one that has come over the last several years to the Northeast, and there's a terrific action and event occurring tomorrow in Philadelphia, which I strongly urge anyone who's in, you know, driving, training, busing distance, and a lot of different groups are co-sponsoring this terrific event, to show up for. It's called Shale Gas Outrage, and it's a rally and a march with some terrific speakers, including today's guest. It's a rally to stop dirty gas drilling and protect air, water, earth, and human health. You can find out more details on the website, Shale, that's S-H-A-L-E, gas, outrage.org, and I'll also just give you a few highlights here. This is something really worth attending. The lead speakers will be Bill McKibben, the environmental leader and president of 350.org. Today's guest, Deborah Rogers, who is a brilliant financial analyst and one of the very first people to really take a good hard look at the promises about fracking and in terms of energy independence and economic growth and what the reality really is. And she comes at this as a financial expert with skills and a depth of knowledge that most of us don't have, and that's what we'll be discussing on today's show. It's very, very important. In addition, people attending Shale Gas Outrage, which begins at noon tomorrow in Philadelphia, we'll also have the opportunity to hear Sandra Steingraber, the ecologist and cancer survivor who's been a prior guest on this show, Josh Fox, the director of Gasland, who's really been the leader in raising awareness about the problems with fracking, and a whole host of other terrific guests, including several musicians. Including Bethany Yarrow, who's a wonderful singer and the daughter of Peter Yarrow, Peter, Paul, and Mary. I had the opportunity to sing with them. Also participating at the rally and speaking, it will be taking place outside the Convention Center at Arch and 13th Street in Philadelphia, PA. Also speaking will be Wes Gillingham of Catskill Mountain Keeper, Doug Shields, a former Pittsburgh City Councilman and a guest on this program multiple times, who really played a great role in getting a ban in Pittsburgh, and Winona Howder, the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, one of the good guy national environmental organizations that really has stood up and stood strong to this issue. So basically, there's a whole day of events that begins at noon outside the Convention Center and that goes on from there. Those wishing to attend the march, it will be starting at Broad and Art Street and ending at Broad and Walnut Street. And then there will be an interfaith event, Blessing the Waters, at the Art Street Methodist Church, and a whole evening of activities as well. And two conferences on day two. Health and gas drilling. This is a terrific event and covers a very understudied and misunderstood issue with this practice. The speakers will include Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald. You can also hear them in the archives and Connect the Dots. We did a full show with them and also featured them at Brooklyn Food Conference in May of 2012. So they are just terrific, and I would highly recommend that. That will begin at 8:30 a.m. and takes place at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Again, all of this information is available on the website shalegasoutrage.org. If you were within any kind of distance to attend, this is a great, great event, highly recommended. Especially for everybody in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania really has been our big wake-up call around the dangers of fracking. On the one hand, we have, a lot of PR from the industry saying, it's safe, there's no problem, we know it's safe. But, on the other hand, we have Pennsylvania. So, encouraging you to attend. And now we'll switch gears and go into the body of the program, where I'm really honored today to have as our guest Deborah Rogers. And she has this industry, it's really hard, it's complicated. And it's complicated to talk about, to figure out, to analyze. It came up rather quickly just since 2005, and we're still catching up with all of the realities and the effects. And so Deborah Rogers is a financial analyst who really has an in-depth knowledge and analysis of the real economics of the industry. She calls this fraconomics, and it's an analysis I think that we very much need and that our policymakers really need to understand and look at, because there have been a lot of myths purveyed that this is a big economic boom for everyone, that this will confer energy independence and free us from foreign oil because we have such abundant reserves. All of these, kind of myths and statements and promises that have been promulgated by the gas industry and sort of swallowed whole, both by politicians and by the general public, you know, really deserve scrutiny before we invest billions of dollars and take enormous environmental, economic, and health risks by going forward with hydraulic fracturing or fracking. So the person who really can tell us about that and who's really drilled into the material is Deborah Rogers. She's the founder of Energy Policy Forum. And listeners, you are in for a real treat. The material's a little heavy going, but you're going to come out knowing so much more than you ever had before. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Deborah Rogers.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So thrilled to have you here. So, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about your own background? Because, you know, there are doctors concerned about this. There are obviously environmentalists concerned about this. There are realtors concerned about fracking, food companies, farms, agricultural people, scientists. There's lots of concerns in lots of directions, but you come from the financial community. Can you just give listeners a little bit of a sense of your own background that you bring to this analysis that you're going to share with us today?
Sure. I got involved with this issue back in 2009. After the economic downturn, I couldn't figure out why they were still, by the way, let me back up a little bit. I live in the Barnett Shale in Texas, in Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. And that was the first of all the shale plays. And after the economic downturn, I could not figure out why they were still out there drilling in such a frenzy. Well, I went to a luncheon, a Chamber of Commerce luncheon, with Aubrey McClendon, who's CEO of Chesapeake Energy. And he was, Mr. McClendon tends to be a bit of a braggart. And he was throwing out numbers and bragging about, you know, production and so forth. And I happen to be kind of one of these nerds that does math in her head, and I was sitting there adding up his figures and thinking, wait a minute, something's wrong here. If I haven't missed something, then we, being we in Texas, have already passed the point of diminishing returns. And so that intrigued me, and I went home and I started looking at the financials of various operators in the Barnett. And what I saw was a bit alarming. They had extraordinarily high levels of debt, very, very low levels of cash. Now, what that means, without having everybody's eyes glaze over, is oil and gas companies typically are cash cows. They just sit on a mountain of cash. But that wasn't the case with these shale operators. They had virtually no cash on their balance sheet. And so it became very clear at that point that the reason they were out there drilling in such a frenzy is because they needed to meet debt service, and they wouldn't be able to pay the banks back if they didn't keep the drilling frenzy up. So a lot of financial analysts, including myself, started referring to this several years ago as a drilling treadmill. They've gotten on, and they can't get off. They have to keep drilling and drilling and drilling. And that's why you see such a proliferation of shale wells. There'll be thousands and thousands of them drilled in, you know, a matter of a year around the country. And the reason for it is pure economics.
So you're saying it's not that they're coming up with a lot of gas, there's a big need for the gas, there's a market for the gas, and then they make money. You're saying that if they don't drill,
they'll go bankrupt.
They go bankrupt? Now, how does that work that they go bankrupt if they don't drill?
Well, because they don't have any cash. And so it's very interesting, and this can get a little bit convoluted, but I'm going to try and explain it as succinctly as I can.
Mm-hmm.
If they default on their loans, then obviously, you know, you're bankrupt, basically. So if you don't have any cash to pay off those loans, then you're going to default. Now, what has been very interesting is there are a lot of different aspects to this story, because in 2009, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, changed the rules for oil and gas, and they expanded the definition of what these companies could claim as reserves. And now what we're seeing is that probably many of these reserves that they've been claiming, well, first of all, let me back up a little bit. We know now for a fact that the operators have been vastly overestimating these reserves.
So in other words, they're saying, I just, you know, doing a little bit just to make sure it's clear for me and listeners and all. So, you know, we've been told, oh, there's a huge abundance of this gas, and it's going to be able to supply us, you know, for decades and decades into the future, and that's why we're being told that this is a bridge to renewables. So if we're saying, so there's all this abundant gas, and that's what we've been told. So the reserves that you're describing are basically how much gas there is going to
that's
be available.
Right.
Now, we've been told there's almost an infinite supply. Okay, so when we're talking about reserves, that's what we're talking about. It's like how much gas is actually there in the ground. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Good.
And
okay.
It turns out that they have overestimated by at least 100% and sometimes as high as 400%.
So that's a big difference. So instead of it being, oh, we have, you know, 50 years of gas, if you've estimated by 100%, then it's more like we only have a few years of actual gas to be brought up from the ground and tapped into. Is that true?
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, the Energy Information Administration, which is part of the Department of Energy, has actually done those calculations. And instead of 100 years of gas, that's, I don't want to go into that, but instead of 100 years of gas, they estimate we actually have about 11 years.
So all of
this siting
and this infrastructure, investment in converting to gas and shipping it abroad and the billions of dollars that are spent to do this conversion in the understanding and money of it paid for by taxpayers and with the understanding that then we will have this supply for years and, you know, 100 years to come is in fact, it's basically leading us off the edge of a cliff because it's huge investment for only not even a dozen years is what you're saying. That's incredible, really. Not to mention the environmental damage and health damage and health risks and, you know, real estate value declines and declines in other industries. I mean, that's a huge shift. Now, are the figures that you're giving, you're saying this is from the Security and Exchange Commission?
No, the reserve figures actually various people have done, worked on, but they're all corroborating one another. So the reserve figures that I'm referring to have been looked at by the U.S. Geological Survey. They have been looked at by the Society of Petroleum Engineers, and they have been looked at by independent private entities, geological entities.
So there's no dispute
and they're all
about
coming
this.
Up
Everyone's
with
agreeing.
That's right, and it's very interesting. For instance, just to give you some numbers, in the Fayetteville play, Chesapeake and Southwestern Energy claim reserves of 2.4 to 2.6 billion cubic feet. Mm-hmm. But just remember the numbers, 2.4 to 2.6. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, however, is that these operators, when they drill a well and it begins producing, they have to log that information with various state regulatory bodies. So in this case, it would be the Arkansas Oil and Gas Commission. Well, what's interesting about that those numbers of 2.4 to 2.6 is that there hasn't been a single well in the Fayetteville play, according to the actual production history filed with the state, that has ever produced more than 1.7 BCF. Mm-hmm. Most of them do struggle to produce even one. And in the case of Chesapeake, their average actual production is 0.5. So as you can see, they're claiming 2.4 to 2.6. Now, if I could elaborate on that a little bit more, because this is a very important point to grasp, under the new SEC rule changes, these operators can borrow monies based on their estimates. And the estimates do not have to be independently verified. And that's very problematic because now that we know we've got a pretty vast overestimation of reserves, then it's logical to assume that these companies have gone out and borrowed a great deal of money on reserves that either don't exist or are not commercially viable to extract.
So let me just kind of summarize my understanding because this is astounding information. So that would be, for example, as if I said, my house – is worth $1 million, and so I am able somehow, to get a million. This wouldn't happen in reality, of course, as we all know nowadays, but supposing I had a lot of clout and I could get $1 million mortgage on my house, but my house is actually only a $200,000 house. So it's that kind of difference, let's say. So that says that when I go to sell, I'm not going to be able to get $1 million for that house to pay back that mortgage. I'm only going to be able to get $200,000, and so that leaves a big gap with somebody holding the bag, for the difference. Is that a good analogy, would you say?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's serious. I mean, so who ends up holding the, what happens then when, in that analogy, if I go out then and I'm $800,000 short in terms of paying back my mortgage, who ends up paying for that? What ends up happening?
I think that you're seeing what's happening about that. If you've kept up with what's happening with Chesapeake Energy, they are in an asset sale frenzy. I mean, it's basically a fire sale. And interestingly enough, just to segue from your point, they have been selling assets. They announced a sale it was actually last week, and they did not get the monies they thought they would get for the assets. So other oil and gas companies realize that these assets are overvalued now.
Wow. So basically, this is, inflated promises and deflated results.
Right.
And on a very, I mean, the proportions of this, the analogy I used was, a $1 million loan on a house, but this is really to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. And who takes the bath when this comes crashing down?
Well, that remains to be seen, but it's been classified by the mainstream financial press as a bubble. You're seeing that now in quite a few headlines that are coming out in publications like the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, et cetera, and they're classifying it as a bubble.
And yet they're still pressing to drill here and drill there, and the reason they're doing that is that if they drill, it's not so much that they can get all the fantastic gas that's needed, but it's really to stave off the day that the bubble bursts, is what it sounds like.
That's right. And also, they go in, a big part of this game has been flipping land. They go in and they pay, let's say, you're a farmer and they pay you $500 an acre to lease your land.
Mm-hmm.
Then what they do is they drill a few wells and they proclaim the field proved up, because they can basically do that now with this expanded definition from the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
But really,
what does proved up mean?
That there's plenty of gas there, and so the entire field is proved that there's, that there the resources are available. But actually, that's not the case, because they've been saying that shale gas is homogeneous, that you can drop a drill bit in any place and hit gas because of the nature of shale. Well, that's not necessarily true. What they found is that you have good wells and you have bad wells, just like in the old days with the more conventional drilling. And I entered into an email exchange with Dr. John Lee, who's a petroleum engineer, and he was actually the architect for the SEC's rule change. And he told me in this email exchange that 80% of shale wells will be uneconomic. 20% will carry the plague. So that means that you're going out, and this is what's problematic about shale, is that it's very land consumptive. I don't know if any of you have flown over Texas recently, but if you look at North Texas when you're flying over, you can see the grid system of the pad sites, and we've got pad sites now roughly every half a mile, north, south, east, and west, over 22 counties. Mm. I mean, it's vast, and each of these pad sites has multiple wells on it. So what he's essentially saying is that when you look at this vast area that's just got pad sites every half a mile, north, south, east, and west, only 20% of those pad sites have wells that are making money. The other 80% are uneconomic. Well, is that the highest and best use of the land? I think those are questions that we ought to be asking, particularly when you move into urban drilling.
Well, I think those are excellent questions, and, you know, in fact, I'd like to discuss that a little bit more going forward, but let me just back up for a second, because I just want to be clear about when you're saying that they then want to flip the land. So they pay, so, I mean, on the one hand, what's immediately obvious is that all the people who are running out to lease their land thinking, you know, they're going to be the ones that have the productive land. Actually, you know, you're saying, you know, only, I guess, one in five. So it's a bit of a kind of crapshoot. So you've, excuse my French, but, you know, you've then mucked up the land and the neighborhoods and the communities and potentially the water supplies of the other 80%, but then it's only this smaller percentage. Now, some people may think that that is a good odd, that's good odds for them if they're quite desperate. They may think that, and it may be good odds, you know, for somebody. But so, you know, there's a whole larger, I think, social analysis about what this does to other kinds of business opportunities or uses of that land, as you, you know, question that you're raising there. But I just want to step back for a second and understand when you say that if they've proven it and then they flip it, who's going to buy it? So, you know, let's say they claim they drilled it. It may be known or unknown whether, in fact, that particular property or, you know, that particular area is going to be, you know, part of the 80% or part of the 20%. How do they flip it? Who wants to buy it? I mean, you know, what gets flipped there? I'm not quite clear about that.
Okay, I apologize because I kind of digressed earlier.
That's okay. I mean, I think it's an important digression, but I just want to be clear about that because, you know, I think it's important to understand this in terms of the whole economics.
Right. So they go in and they pay the farmer, say, $500 an acre. Then mm-hmm. they supposedly prove up the acreage and they flip it. And who they're flipping it to is typically other oil and gas companies. That's what's been interesting about this, although that is not unusual. This has kind of been a pattern throughout the oil and gas industry history. But they flip it, and they flip it for multiples of what they've paid the farmer. And to give you an example again, Aubrey McClendon made a comment to financial analysts a couple of years ago. He said, why do I need to drill for gas at $5 to $6 an MCF? And right now it's under, you know, it's around $3. But at that time he said, why do I need to drill for $5 to $6 when I can flip the land and make 10 to 20 times my money?
Well, and who's going to pay that if the gas is not?
The other oil and gas companies. And
why?
When they go in to buy these, some of the larger companies are now, you're seeing them go in to buy these assets from the smaller companies. That's been happening for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this is if you look at a company like BHP Billiton, which is an enormous company out of Australia, and they went in and they bought up shale assets in the Fayetteville and the Haynesville. And within a matter of months, literally, they had to take an impairment charge, which was more than 50% of the amount that they had paid for the assets, for the Fayetteville assets. And for that gets a little bit complicated, but an impairment charge basically is each year these companies have to do what they call mark-to-market their assets. They have to look and see if this is the fair market value for these assets. And because that company is Australian, they have to follow the international accounting rules, and they're a bit more strict than U.S. accounting rules. Mm. And so if those assets are not worth any longer what you're claiming them to be worth on your books, you have to make an adjustment.
Oh,
and
boy.
So they had to make an adjustment of more than 50% of the value that they had paid for the assets.
Wow. So in other words, you know, just so to follow through in that thought, so therefore they're flipping it to other companies, but then that other company may be left with a depressed asset that's worth less than they paid for it. So the information that you're offering us here on the program today, it seems that perhaps the companies are not even aware. The other companies, can they possibly be unaware of this inflated value and then the deflated value that will follow? I mean, they're selling this to other companies, and then the companies are going to be holding the bag when the bubble bursts, and they are not aware of these inflated expectations of gas output that we're discussing on today's show?
Well, obviously, I can't answer for a company like BHP because I'm not privy to that information, but that
right.
has certainly been the question that a lot of financial analysts are asking. Did you really do your due diligence properly?
Mm-hmm. So they could just be caught up in an enthusiastic sell and not really have drilled in and understood the kind of information you're sharing with us on today's show.
Well, I mean, I can't answer that because I'm not.
Yeah,
privy,
but I mean, hypothetically, that must be what's going. It's kind of amazing. I don't understand how that level of investing works. So to me, it sounds incredible. But you know, I guess that you know there are feeding frenzies in the investment markets as in elsewhere, and people get, you know, companies, even large companies can get carried along and be ending up holding the bag potentially. This is very interesting stuff.
I have been referring to shale gas for the last several years as tulip mm-hmm. mania. If you recall the tulip mania in Holland,
mm-hmm.
And where everyone gets caught up in, you know, this euphoria about mm-hmm. something, and they've done a good job. They've done a very good public relations job. I mean, you can't turn on the television without seeing a natural gas ad.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a very good job of promoting this and convincing everybody that it's abundant and that it's going to, you know, make us energy independent. That is another point that's very interesting about this game as well, is that even though they have been talking very publicly about energy independence, behind the scenes, they were doing something else altogether different. And they were mentioning it in analyst calls, financial analyst calls, as long mm-hmm. ago as 2008. And that was that they wanted to export the gas. And when you were talking about what makes these large companies want to get into the gas, I think that part of it was the euphoria, and part of it was that they want access to these assets, even though they may not be as great as purported at present, they would like to be able to export that gas to foreign nations, particularly China. And the reason for that is that natural gas is indexed to the price of crude
mm-hmm.
every place in the world except North America. So when I do presentations, I always ask people, how many of you think that crude prices will be the same 20, 30 years from now that they are today? And, of course, none of us think that. We think
mm-hmm.
they'll be significantly higher. Well, that means natural gas prices are going to be significantly higher. But let's step back and look what the natural gas industry is promoting on television in their ads and so forth. They're telling us that we need to convert our power plants, we need to convert our truck fleets, et cetera, to run on more natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're petitioning the Department of Energy to flip what used to be existing LNG, and LNG stands for liquid natural gas,
mm-hmm.
and have to liquefy it in order to ship it to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we have import terminals in this country, but we had no export terminals. So mm-hmm. they went to the Department of Energy behind the scenes, very quietly. None of this is in television ads. And they said, mm-hmm. we want you to flip those and allow us to export this gas. They received their first permit last October, and they will begin to export our gas. Right now, just in the permit applications, they have committed a minimum of 20% of the shale gas to be exported overseas. Representative Markey has asked for, or he's begun trying to get legislation through which won't allow exportation, because if they export that gas, it will drive up our domestic price. There's no doubt about it. And the reason it will drive up our domestic price is because if you take the price of natural gas right now, at this moment in time, in the U.S., it's around $3, roughly. In China, for the exact same amount of gas, they're paying as much as $16. So if you're an oil and gas company, who do you want to sell your product to? The person who's going to pay you $3 or the person who's going to pay you $16? None of us has to think very long about that. So once they are able to export, which will be, they will have the capabilities and everything should be set up by about the end of 2014, then that price, our domestic price, will go up because of the international pricing pressures. Are you following me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
So in other words, we will be more dependent.
I just
need to summarize, Deborah, here, because we need to take a break here, and then we'll come back and discuss this more. But basically, we will have paid the price for the infrastructures. We will have paid the price in terms of the economic damage and economic damage to other industries, to homes, to property values, all of that. We will be paying the health costs. But the gas will no longer be at an affordable rate for use here, and it will go abroad, and a certain percentage of investors will, you know, a small group of investors will make a lot of money off of it on the backs of the American people in 30-plus states. I mean, that's the scenario that you're describing. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and discuss this more. We're talking with Deborah Rogers, financial analyst extraordinaire about Fractonomics. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and please stay with us, listeners, for the second half of Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On today's show, I am thrilled to be talking with Deborah Rogers, a financial analyst who is the founder of Energy Policy Forum, and has really done and continue to track a deep analysis of the real economics behind fracking, who benefits, who doesn't benefit, what the myths and false expectations are. We've been hearing all about that on the first half of the show, and we'll continue that discussion now in the second half. But before we resume, I just wanted to point interested listeners to Deborah Rogers' wonderful website, energypolicyforum.com. And you can go there to find her articles, news. I heard her speak in New York late winter, spring, I think it was, and was just blown away. And it's been very interesting on today's show time doesn't stand still, and her analysis and the evolving story behind the real economics of fracking continues to move forward. So, you know, this is really something to follow and keep track of. Deborah will be a lead speaker at Shale Gas Outrage, taking place in Philadelphia tomorrow and Friday as well, with a follow-up health assessment program. You can join that event if you're interested at noon tomorrow outside the convention center at Arch and 13th Street, and there you'll also have a chance to hear Bill McKibben and a whole bunch of other terrific people. If you've enjoyed this show, please pass it along to your friends. It will be available in archives at Progressive Radio Connect the Dots very shortly, and also rate us on iTunes if you enjoy the program. And you can keep up with my writing and upcoming blogging and everything at Alternet by following me on Huffington or at my own website, healthjournalistblog.com. So, returning to my conversation with Deborah Rogers. The kind of big picture takeaway, Deborah, that we were discussing in the earlier part of the program is that there will be some profits for some people, or some entities, maybe corporations who aren't people, but it'll be on the backs of a whole lot of other people. Would you, from what you're saying, it's clear that the general public is not going to get its gas needs met, despite the promises that have been made. And, you know, that seems pretty clear. But I guess the question is, so I think, you know, in terms of the fact that so many citizens are concerned about this, it really validates that for them, all the things on the concerns, troubles, worries, costs, losses side of the ledger are very real for the average citizen that isn't anywhere near any of these shale plays or downstream from them. And it even sounds like, you know, in terms of investors, there'll be some winners and some losers in terms of, you know, the kind of sort of gas, the land leased areas where the gas drilling is in the, you know, the kind of 80% that isn't very productive. So it even sounds like it's a kind of a high risk game for investors.
Right,
and some will win out, some won't. Is that right?
Even of the 80%, I mean, of the 20% that the wells make money, you have to keep in mind that if you've done your calculations based on what the gas companies, the operators told you that the wells, the average reserve should be, and that's how people do the calculations to figure out what they're going to, their royalty, or, you know, to estimate what their royalty payments will be, your numbers that you've based that off of are way too high. That's what we found. They're vastly overestimated. So if you calculated estimated royalties for, say, your property, you've almost certainly calculated far too high.
So this is, you know, one of the questions I had going into this is, you know, shale gas fracking bonanza or boondoggle. So it sounds like it's, you know, potential bonanza for a very narrow group, but it may not be easy to predict who that is because until these wells are proven, no one knows for sure. And then it's going to be, or it may even be for people upline, but for many people, it is going to be a boondoggle. Now, you've seen that in, I guess, the Barnett Shale in Texas, so that's been a kind of wake-up call. So all of the dreams that Americans have been sold about energy independence, all of the, you know, dreams that I know exist in areas where leasing is happening, that, you know, they're going to go live in a tropical isle, what is the reality of the economics that the, you know, on the downside of this, if you could give us a kind of tour of that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I like to talk a lot about the Barnett and the Fayetteville and so forth, and the reason I do that is because these are the older plays, so there's much more production history that we can look at. There's, we now can see what is the cumulative effect, environmental effect of all these wells and all this drilling. And interestingly enough, every single one of these plays has followed the exact same pattern, basically. And so whatever happens in the Barnett or the Fayetteville or the Haynesville is going to happen in the Marcellus. And even going into the other areas like Eagle Ford and Bakken, where they're drilling more for oil in the shales. But they're all following the same pattern. And that is that the wells are not as long-lived as industry claimed. What we're finding, industry claims typically that these plays will play out for 30 to anywhere between 30 and 60 years. It's usually 30, 40, 50 years. What we're finding is that the average well is done. It's finished by year 7. 85% of the well has been played out by year 5, so they're very short-lived. They have very high initial production, so the wells produce well in the first 12 months, and then it drops off a cliff, and they don't produce much of anything after that. They have to go in and refracture stimulate them. So you're talking about fracturing again and again and again over the life of the well. That's very, very expensive to do. And as far as the environmental degradation, Texas is a great example of that, unfortunately. We now know our regulatory body for the environment is called TCEQ, Texas Commission for Environmental Quality. It's the equivalent of the DEC. And they submitted a report, they had to EPA at December, year-end 2011. And basically they stated that gas drilling is contributing significantly more volatile organic compounds than all the cars, trucks, and airplanes in the region combined. And it's in excess of 40% more than all the cars, trucks, and airplanes in the region combined. And this is a huge metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, for me, the most problematic is the fact that our childhood asthma rates are off the charts. The national average is about 7%, and in North Texas, where the drilling is occurring, and this is, by the way, this is correlated to the time when drilling really took off from that time onward, our childhood asthma rate now is 25%. So there are significant health problems. Houston Advanced Research Center just came out with a paper about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, stating that gas drilling facilities are contributing significantly to ozone, and that there is no way we here in North Texas will meet any, I mean, even come near to federal targets for ozone, because unless the drilling industry begins to use much more pollution control devices, you know, they have refused to use those every place. And the reason they refuse to use them is because the wells don't make money and they don't want to spend any more money on them. But this talk about we use state-of-the-art equipment and so forth is just rubbish. They don't.
So actually, this is interesting also, Deborah, because I have a new blog that will be coming up on Alternet within the next few days, 2 weeks, hopefully. And in it, I raise the issue, you know, there's been a kind of tug of war with some people saying we need a ban against fracking and let's not bring it into New York State where I reside, for example, and others saying, well, it can be regulated. And in fact, the mayor of New York has just made a $30 million gift to the Environmental Defense Fund to develop regulations. But others say that the problem with that is that the industry will not comply, and we've seen in Pennsylvania how regulation resistant they have been. So what you're explaining to us here is the reason why. They're operating on such a narrow margin there, it seems like, that they can't afford.
That's right. They're losing money on virtually every one of these wells.
So the picture, all the money is spent on PR kind of saying, you know, look what a great, beautiful thing this is, but it's like the picture of Dorian Gray that hangs in the closet, and they are struggling desperately to survive. They can't give an inch to make this safer because it's such a fragile margin. I mean, how does that square with the fact that some percentage will be making out when this is liquefied and sold abroad? I mean, how does that, you know, add up? I guess since no one knows who that's going to be, that's going to have the productive well, it's too high risk. Is that correct, or is there some other reason?
Well, when you look at what are the costs of drilling these wells, what's the average cost? And now, this has been corroborated by a number of independent sources. Everyone's pretty much in agreement. Now, different plays cost different amounts, like the Marcellus. Let's talk about the Marcellus for a minute. The break-even costs for Marcellus are probably somewhere between $4 and $5. So until natural gas rises up to $4 and $5, they're not even breaking even. Okay? In some of the other plays, the costs are significantly more. In the Barnett, it's about $6 to $7 probably. And in the Haynesville, it can be as much as $8 to $10 because those wells are very, very deep. But you're going to have to get, if you're an operator, you're going to have to get $4 to $5 for your gas in the Marcellus just to break even. Now, if you can export that gas and you can drive the domestic price up because of international pricing pressures, then, you know, we may end up with $6 to $7 gas, and that may make the Marcellus profitable at that time, and that's what they're banking on. But, well, anyway, go ahead.
Until that happens.
Until that happens, they're losing money, and so they're not going to want to spend any more on these wells than they absolutely have to.
And they don't know, you know, which ones are going to be the ones. So, and so and there's an arc. So they have a long-term, you know, path potentially to profitability, but with a lot of broken bodies and bankrupted companies and bankrupted regions along the way. What is the effect economically, you know, of shale gas extraction on a region? The promise has been, you know, that it's a boon for everyone. Like, you know, the supposed rationale to bring it to New York State is that, you know, this is going to be making a lot of money, bringing a lot of jobs. Can you just discuss that aspect for a few moments for our listeners, please?
Yeah, you know, the jobs question is always one that interests me, because now I look at things really from a macro view, because I don't have the time or the inclination really to go in and look at individual communities, because that's an enormous job to look at. But if you look at the macro view, let's talk about that for a minute, because it's very, very interesting. Let's take away all the induced and ancillary jobs, which the industry loves to claim, because that's where they get those multiples that knock the jobs numbers up to 600,000, you know, in ranges that are just off the charts. Let's just look at direct industry jobs, and let's look at them during the so-called shale gas revolution. So what I did was I went back and did some research through the Bureau of Labor Statistics and found out that in 2003, and shale really kind of took off in the Barnett in about 2002, but it really took off about 2006. But I decided, let's go back and look at the 10 years that shale, you know, they've been doing hydrofracking for shales. Okay. In 2003, the total direct industry jobs, now this is all oil and gas jobs, onshore and offshore. So this isn't just natural gas. This is all oil and gas jobs. Okay. It hit a low point of about 118,000. By year end 2011, which is not quite a decade, but pretty close, it had grown to 186,000 jobs. Now, they did grow some jobs over that decade, basically, but it's only 67,900 jobs over nearly a decade. So to put that into perspective, during the shale gas revolution, and when we were supposed to be creating a frenzy of jobs, they created, in the entire oil and gas sector, only 67,900 jobs, and that is 1/20 of 1% of our overall labor market. Now, to my mind, that's not a game changer. That's not revolutionary.
And so then the other ancillary jobs are, you know, the person who comes and cleans in the man camp and the people who supply the food while they're there, and then they go. And meanwhile, because we're coming to the end of our show, what kind of losses economically do regions with shale gas extraction experience on the debit side?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, because you have to take into account, even though you may gain, let's say they claim you'll gain 20,000 jobs, and I'm just throwing that figure out there, but let's say you'll gain 20,000 jobs, direct and induced jobs from shale gas extraction. Well, you have to look at how many other jobs are going to be lost. How many jobs are going to be lost in organic farming? How many jobs are going to be lost in, like in upstate New York with the tourist industry? Because those jobs will be lost. If you start pockmarking your landscape in the way that they have to pockmark it in order to extract shale, which is, as I stated before, roughly every half a mile, north, south, east, and west, you're going to have a pad site, and they are not pretty. If you start doing that, you're going to have job losses in other sectors. And indeed, they've found that in the heaviest drilled areas of Pennsylvania, other sectors have been absolutely decimated.
So we're coming down to the end of our show, and have to sign off. I would love to have you back again and connect the dots. This is just so fascinating. But, you know, the big takeaway is that inflated projections Most of what's the lowered projections of what's really going to be coming forth are going to be sold abroad, not providing energy independence here. Inflated job projections, not really a game changer, as you say, and depleted values and loss, economic loss from these activities. And that's just not even counting home value, property value decline, mortgage bankruptcy, health impacts and costs, all the rest of it. So I guess we've kind of sketched out some answers to the question, shale gas fracking bonanza or boondoggle. Thank you so much for being with me today. Deborah Rogers, it's been great having you. And please, listeners, check out Energy Policy Forum for ongoing articles. Also, love to have you back for regular updates. And you can see Deborah and hear her at Shale Gas Outrage in Philadelphia on the 20th of September. Thank you, listeners. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and please be with us again next week on the Progressive Radio Network for Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Wednesdays Eastern Time.